Okay, I'm joined in studio by Councillor Declan Meehan, independent councillor in the Letterkenny Milford Municipal District, and husband Parig Podge McGuinness, a GP. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to have you in. Is it often you two get to sit down with each other? I don't mean it funny, because I'm thinking you phone never has to be off. Yeah. Maybe you can be a bit more structured with your time, Parig, I don't know. But is it? Do you struggle to sort of get the time?
Sometimes. I think we're quite good at putting time aside in the evenings, or well, late evenings or nighttime during the week. And usually we do get some time over the weekends as well, actually.
Yeah, I think you have to. If you don't set time aside, you end up just being ships in the night constantly.
Yeah.
And definitely there was a time when that was worse, but I think we've got better at managing that now.
It's something you have to work on, isn't it? And definitely. I don't mean you two have to work on. We all have to sort of work on.
Exactly. Because
you can very easy fall into a norm, don't you?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, they're both very important jobs, I would argue. How do you get on, personality-wise?
How do we get on?
Yeah.
Well, we get on very well, yeah. We've been together now 12 years. We've been married for 7 years nearly.
Yeah.
And we get on great. We have a very happy life. We both are very lucky in that we're in jobs that we absolutely love. We really enjoy them. I think that is key. It's key to happiness when you're spending so much time working, that if you enjoy it, then that makes it so much better. And then we have lots of shared interests, so that kind of obviously helps as well. So
How did you sort of find your way, it sounds like you stumbled into medicine, Parig. How did, what was your pathway to your career?
Yeah, I was a bit of a, I took the long way around. So I was a pharmacist first. I actually went to college when I was 17 to do pharmacy in the UK. And then I worked for a little while in that. I had a successful career, and then went back when I was about 24. I went back and did medicine in Belfast. And it was just, pharmacy is a great career and there's some wonderful pharmacists around. I just found that it wasn't really for me, and it wasn't really the career for me. So I went back and did 5 years of medicine. And
was that because it didn't perhaps interest you as much as it could, or you felt you had more to give? Shade on pharmacists, don't get me wrong.
They're just two very different careers, actually. Yeah. Pharmacy is a wonderful career, and they get an awful hard time because they're on the high street and they don't know what's coming through the door at them next, or what abuse many times they're going to get next. But they're terrific people, and we're blessed in this county in particular with lots of great pharmacists. It just, for me, I just wanted to do something differently. I think I wanted more patient contact. I wanted more patient involvement. And that's what medicine, and certainly what GP gives me. Yeah.
Yeah. And how many years do you have to do studying to become a GP?
5 years of med school first, and then 1 or 2 years of an internship. So I did mine in Northern Ireland. So it's Foundation 1 and 2, and then 3 or 4 years, depending whether it's North or South, on GP training. So all told, somewhere around 10 years in a row.
I really don't have that level of commitment to anything. What about you?
Well, you're crucially getting paid after 5 years of something.
Right, okay,
so that helps somewhere.
Okay, yeah. you've drawn me back in there.
Yeah.
And in general practitioner, you have to know, and this is, sounds like I'm doing it a disservice or not, you have to know a little or a lot about a lot. Or do GPs have areas of speciality, and i.e. what would be your area of speciality within the wider field?
Yeah, I suppose we describe ourselves as expert generalists, probably. We know a little bit, a lot. And a lot of it's pattern recognition. A lot of it is recognizing what's serious, what's not serious, what can be managed, what needs to be managed today, what can be pushed out a little bit, all those kind of things. Lots of GPs have special interests. I have a bit of a special interest in palliative care. I do a lot of teaching. I teach a day or two a week for the university. I do a bit of regulatory stuff for the Irish Medical Council. So most GPs would have special interest in other things that tries to make your day job Monday to Friday interesting and something different. For me, though, nothing really beats being in the practice. It's what I live for, really. I really, really enjoy it. I love going to work every day. I don't have that dread that people have of going to work. I don't think, the week is long. I really enjoy it. And, you know, I often talk about this sort of, or all GPs will talk about like this cradle to grave thing. But last year I had this patient who died, and she was in her 90s and was called one morning to sadly pronounce her. And then 15 minutes later, I was back in the surgery and my stethoscope was on a 2 week old doing a 2 week baby check. And I just had this moment where I was like, this is, you know, and a really excited new parents in with their newborn and a really sad family. And that literally is GP. You are 1 minute doing the happiest thing, the next minute doing the saddest thing. And it's an incredible privilege to be with families through their highs and lows.
You have those highs, of course, and they can put a pep in your step, but also there is the lows where you have to, you know, I'm sure you've referred people and you kind of know whether you say it or not or whatever. And you know, in that moment, you know, perhaps there's something that's going to make a significant difference to people's lives. How do you deal with that? I mean, you can't carry that with you, can you? You have to find some way to compartmentalize it. It doesn't mean you don't care, but you can't go home every day with that, can you?
No. Well, breaking bad news, I suppose, is a part of any GP's life, and we do it on a, sadly, on an almost weekly basis. And I always tell the medical students, if it's not affecting you, then you're in the wrong job. You know, it should be affecting you. You should be feeling compassion and empathy for your fellow human that's getting bad news like that. And I often think, if it was me or my family getting bad news, how would they like to receive it, and try and do it in that way? I think you do have to take a moment afterwards. I don't think you can go from giving bad news and then go straight into being jolly with a new 2 week old baby or whatever. And we often, GPs have techniques for that. We often do it at the end of surgeries, for example, or stuff like that, where we know that we'll have time, to talk to the patient as much as they want, but also that you can end up going home then and decompressing on that. But I'd be lying if I didn't tell you that I bring some of those conversations home in my head and that I ruminate on them a little bit. But I think that's the same with any clinician.
And it's the same with you, Declan, because, you know, I mean, I think the job of a public representative is somewhat misunderstood, if you know what I mean. And the bits that we see, or the bits we hear you talking about, or the stuff at the council meeting. But also, you know, you're being contacted by people in desperate situations. It could be a woman in an abusive relationship. It could be a family living in poverty. And they're saying to you, you know, what can you do for us? Mm-hmm. I mean, you do as much as you can, but at the same time, the reality is that you have to go home and go, well, you know what, I wasn't able to, you know, make the difference that I would love to be able to make.
Yeah, and that's a frustration that comes with being a public representative, definitely, but it is also a privilege, you know, when people are coming to you with their problems like that. And that's the part of the job that I love the most. You know, I love so many different elements of it, but ultimately I love, you know, helping people and being there for people as much as you can. You can't always help people. That is the frustration. There's some things that are way above your pay grade, way above your capability as a county councillor, but I always try and find some way of pointing them in the right direction and guiding them along the right path to getting what they need. And that's not always easy. And yeah, sometimes you are, you know, confronted with, you know, really dire situations with people. And that can be tough. But again, you kind of have to view it as a privilege that people are coming to you in that way. And as I say, that's the kind of part of the job that I really, really like. And just trying to find something that's going to improve their situation even slightly is a win, you know?
Yeah, the reality of local politics for most people is that you need an additional job. You know, there's not many people can make it a full-time job, and if so, it's for other circumstances. So obviously you have your ongoing work, and it's sort of community-focused as well. But at what point did you, or is there a point where you go, I would like to get into elected politics?
To be very honest, I have always wanted to get into elected politics. Yeah. Even as a teenager, politics is something that always interested me. It's something that I was always very passionate about as well. And for me, it's kind of, I think sometimes it's kind of old fashioned or maybe corny to say this, but genuinely, I'm driven by a desire to, you know, participate in public service. And that's always what has driven my interest in politics, and elected politics obviously being the kind of best manifestation of that. So it was something that I always wanted to do. When I went away, I lived away for 10 years between Dublin and Belfast. It was always in my mind to come back to Donegal, to get into elected politics here, to be part of hopefully improving, you know, the area or people's lives in my own home county, as opposed to doing that in Dublin or doing that in Belfast. I always wanted to come home to that. So it was always something that I was interested in doing.
But you and you are doing it, and you're doing it successfully, of course. But I mean, did any part of you think that if I was in a different area or a different constituency, that it might be easier for me to get a pathway, say, even into the Dáil or what have you? You know, I mean, you're incredibly well received here, but I think Donegal is conservative. Is it? I don't know. Has that ever worked against you? I don't know. That's not a loaded question. Yeah, I genuinely have no idea of the answer.
I think, like previously, that would have been something that you would take into consideration. Yeah. I don't see Donegal as a conservative county or a place. I think that people's opinions on different issues change depending on what those issues are. I think it was, like for me, you know, the biggest, I suppose, kind of boost was topping the poll in 2024 in a very rural part of Donegal, the Milford electoral area. And I don't see that, you know, anything like that would have held me back. Do I think that I could have had an easier run in a different constituency or a different area?
And I think maybe too, sorry, I'm probably talking about the next step up in politics, if you know what I mean. So aspirations of a Dáil seat or what have you, where you have to sort of draw in from across the county.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know? And you have to tap into that 50% that voted one way in something else that might not agree with you. You know, that sort of a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, that's not on my radar right now.
Why not?
Look, they say a week is a long time in politics, 2 or 3 years. Well,
can I just say, if you leave your politics at that Dáil here and just answer the question straight?
No, but genuinely, it is something, obviously, that I think most people who are in elected politics consider, right?
Yeah.
It's obviously something that I have considered and will consider, but it's not a dead cert for me.
Yeah.
I'm very much focused on the job I have currently, and I really enjoy that
job. I get you, and that is the right answer, because certain circumstances have to align, don't they? It has to be the right thing at the right time. Parig, do you just let him at it, or would you be inclined to say that, hold on a second, I know you could go up there and make a big difference, stop sitting on the fence?
Well, I would be conscious of the fact that I'd be away 3 nights a week in Dublin, which would leave us, me and my Cocker Spaniel,
to have little together. Netflix of flares like I do.
yeah, that would be it. No, look, I've been interested in politics my whole life, pre-Declan, and was involved in student politics and political parties and all those things. So it kind of comes naturally to me. And, you know, wherever Declan decides to go politically, and whatever decision we make as a team on that in the long grass, I'll support him in that, depending on what that is. And you're quite right, Greg, it depends on timing and situations, and there's so many factors. But right now it's very happy that he gets to come home most nights of the week. Yeah.
But I'd be aware on you know, there's various issues, you know, not least maybe the surgical hub and stuff, and maybe we can dig a little bit deeper into that as well too, that, you know, and there was some positive news as we record that podcast in relation to that. But both of you had a significant influence in that. And I'm, you know, you would be amongst a whole group of people that worked tirelessly to get that over the line, but it had to be done behind the scenes. But there's absolutely no doubt that, you know, between your, both of you were public facing in that, don't get me wrong, but with your knowledge and understanding, Parig, and of course with your platform, Declan, and what have you, you know, there's a lot of unsung heroes, I think, in that whole surgical hub, for an example, and other issues as well.
Yeah. Look, I think that the success of that campaign is the sheer amount of how many people were actually involved in it, from the community advocates and campaigners who've been campaigning for years, whether it's from the ambulatory care centre or increased capacity with regards to surgery, the staff in the hospital themselves, you know, the GPs and the consultants all coming together. All of those were pivotal moments, but also that kind of unity that wasn't there initially, but, you know, by necessity became or eventually fell into place across the political spectrum. We both worked on that, and it's something that I think was just something that obviously appealed to the two of us in probably very similar ways, but also different ways and coming out from different perspectives. I think that one of the things that we have in common is an absolute intolerance for injustice, or absolutely anything that promotes or prolongs inequality. And the surgical hub was a really, really, I think,
lightning rod for that.
Yeah, lightning rod for that, absolutely. So working together on that as we did through the wider kind of consortium of different people involved, it was something that we were very pleased to work on. And
I think it did consume a lot of our life for a number of months.
Well, this is where I was trying to get to, because again, and I want you to expand on that, Padraig, as well, because again, and I wanted to tease it out, because I don't think necessarily there'd be that much knowledge of that, because people see bits and pieces of it. So how all-consuming was it? And talk us through that a little bit.
I suppose, well, firstly, I'm very proud of it. And I think what we did together as two teams or two teams of people in the politicians and in the medics and staff, I think I'm very proud of what we did is the first thing to say. I think it was all-consuming because at the start you have this whole, we want to get involved and do something, and we were both sort of approached separately about that. And then it becomes all-consuming. It's like, well, what is the strategy? How do you develop a campaign? It doesn't happen by accident that you end up with a national campaign where you can ask a minister to come down and intervene in something. You don't get that chance very often to do, and it's only on certain issues and certain lightning rods that you can do that, and that was the case. And then I suppose it was the right place at the right time, I think, on this issue. And I think, to be fair, Greg, you were also a huge advocate for it, which helped a lot. Keeping it constantly in the media works well. But it meant that every dinner table for those couple of weeks and months was a discussion about what was happening that day, or, you know, you'd be texting over and back multiple times a day trying to figure out what the next step of the plan was and trying to help.
And you could see it evolving to, you know, there were points where, and I'm sure you know that, not I'm sure you know, but you're privy to all of this. I'm not, I'm just hear this stuff. But, you know, whereby there were timing issues, right, we've achieved that, let's take a break. And then others say, no, well, there's a momentum here, we need to keep going. Yeah. And, you know, it was a far more strategic and organized than perhaps people listening to this would realize.
Well, there was it was a huge organization behind it, and there was so many people involved in that, and there was a strategic plan, and there's too many people here to mention and to thank for that. But there was a plan in place, and we stuck to it, and I think it was a good blueprint on how we could be better advocates ourselves for healthcare in Donegal in general, not just about the hospital, but in general about healthcare in Donegal, and maybe about Donegal broadly, about saying about how we fight together for things. We've all seen the maps about the different injustices for Donegal. And I think there is something around that, taking one thing at a time, getting it achieved and moving on to the next thing.
But I get emails and it'd be like, you know, absolutely not for publication. Absolutely. And I'm like, well, what are you setting the meeting for? Yeah. Can I even reference it if I'm doing it? You know what I mean? Like, it's like, well, okay, so I'll, it's like it'll self-destruct after 5 seconds. Yeah, and then eventually it would all make sense. But I'm like, this is very, very frustrating.
Yeah.
But, you know, such was the forensic nature of that campaign. And you know, just the fact that both of you so, and I actually am too, I hate injustices and as well. It would be great if we had a different way of doing things, isn't it? Because there are examples and times you can prove that it doesn't have to be that way.
Hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And yet there's so much of it going on. And it can be right at the you know, the national level, the international level, right down to the macro level. You like about why, how can we have, you know, 450,000 kids or whatever it is at the moment in food poverty? Yeah. I mean, you know, it's really frustrating.
I think though on that particular example, and I think it has to be acknowledged that, you know, there was an attempt at a campaign. There was a campaign from the doctors previously with Stephen Donnelly as Minister for Health that, you know, got some concessions, but ultimately very reluctantly, and from a minister who didn't want to engage. And I think one of the other big differences in those two campaigns was there was a Minister for Health who wanted to engage, that actually wanted to listen, who was evidence driven and evidence motivated. And that was definitely in our favour as well.
I agree.
Makes for a huge, huge difference when you have someone competent.
And in fairness, and she's followed through, and you can follow that, you can follow how she's followed through, but it proves to me though what difference political will can make.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, a lot through that process, it was embarrassment and pressure and calling out and gotchas.
Yeah.
That seem to have it. That's, is that what it takes to actually get people into a position to prove that you can actually make life-changing decisions?
Yeah, I that's definitely part of it, right? Those gotchas. But sometimes those gotchas don't work. They're like water off a duck's back with certain people. And I think that that was the difference, that we were engaged in that. But the other thing as well is, I think members of the public want to see politicians, regardless of their political parties or none, working together for the betterment of Donegal, for the constituency, for the county. And that was a great example of that. And there should be more of it, but there isn't. But there should be more of it. It should not be impossible for someone from a government party, for example, to stand up and say, this is not right in Donegal and we're not sitting down and we're not going to shut up about it until it's sorted. But we see that way too often.
But then, of course, there is you to some extent, and I'm not a great analysis in this area. Party politics is almost feels with the type of democracy we have required, because otherwise, can you imagine if it was just a, you know what I mean? So I don't know.
I don't know if you'd say that to the people of Kerry, though.
Huh?
I don't know if you'd say that to the people of Kerry.
That's quite true, but that's a generational thing. How long can that continue, either? I think just before we move on, the biggest thing for me about politics is low turnouts, to be honest with you. I really think it's time we start considering sort of that Australian model or whatever it might be. They get 90% turnouts. Mm-hmm. You know, I think if there was more accountability, it might tidy up the discourse a little bit as well. Do you know what I mean? Whereas people say, well, I don't vote because blah, blah, blah. Well, you had to vote, and you know, which way did you vote, and put something behind your argument. I just think there's too few people really making the decisions in the public.
Yeah, and look at the political spectrum, if you like, whose interest is that in? It's kind of in the interest of establishment parties to kind of keep voter turnout low. And voter turnout will remain low unless they're given an alternative or they're given a reason to come out and vote. And I think that we've seen that even, say, you know, in different countries where there is, you know, a bright alternative that people engage with and feel like they can engage with, that, you know, it drives voter turnout, it increases it. So I think that I don't agree with mandatory voting. I think it's people's right to stay at home if they feel like a campaign, whether it's a referendum or an election, doesn't engage them at all, that they can sit at home and say, I'm not participating.
Yes, but I the reason I would push back a little bit on that is that I think that's where an awful lot of the online stuff comes from.
Sure.
Yeah, and I actually just think if everyone had to have a say, I'd just be interested to see what impact it might have on that. Yeah. Maybe it'd have no impact at all, but anyway. But Porrick, are you content to be able to do the advocacy work, you know, the on top of your GP work, you know, slide a few things his way to get out into the public, maybe? I don't know if you do that, perhaps you do. Or would you have your own political ambitions as well? Because it would seem like you're a perfect fit for it as much as your husband here.
Yeah, I suppose there definitely was a time in my past, Greg, where I thought that I would have ran for public office. I don't think so anymore. I don't think it's my vibe. I'm very happy being a GP and doing lots of stuff on the side, and very happy being the politician's husband. I don't, and you know, that's a role in itself, as you just alluded to, but also I just don't know nowadays whether I would be fit for the all-consuming public of being elected representative, of the online abuse you get, of the online torture you get in particular, or the threats and all those things. And I don't, thankfully. No one seems to be attacking me online for being a GP or for advocating for certain things. And there's
I haven't asked my tough questions yet.
Yeah. just wait.
No, I'm only joking.
Yeah, but I don't know. I don't think it's an easy job.
That's really, really regrettable. Because to be honest with you, there are perhaps more, not more vulnerable demographics, but like women in politics as well. Mm-hmm. It's I'm not saying there's a hierarchy, but to some extent there is, you know, of online abuse and all that type of stuff. It's crazy that it's got to that. And we'll tease that out a little bit more with you. But there's a guy sitting to your right who is in the public eye. We're having this conversation right now, and it's quite likely, you know, let's all be honest, it's quite likely a clip might be pulled out at some point and framed in a certain way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? Look at...
You know where I'm coming from. We don't... Yeah. And that is, unfortunately, it's something I have to accept, you have to accept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's all part of it now, isn't it? And like, it's a shame in some ways that it's part of it, but that is the world we live in, and that's the reality. You know, social media in particular is an exceptionally good tool at getting your message out when you're a public representative, of keeping people informed of what you're doing or responding to queries or whatever else. But it's a double-edged sword, big time. And that is unfortunate. It goes with the territory. It's not something that we should just go, oh, well, you accept it and you get on with it. But it is part of it. And I don't know what the answer to it is. I've said this before. I thank God that my mother isn't on social media.
Yeah.
To see some of the stuff that, you know, is sometimes said or spread or whatever. But yeah, it is. It's the worst part of.
I know you don't mind criticism. That's not what we're talking about here, right?
Yeah.
But what kind of abuse do you get that we might not know about, if you know what I mean? Like, you do hear, certainly on the national stage or people in the public eye, you know, they will get literal threats on their health, yeah, or intimidation. Or is it, you know, adult version of school ground bullying stuff? Like, what is your...
It's all of the above, unfortunately. Right. So I have received death threats of violence against our home. That has happened a few times previously. There's also obviously a lot of homophobic abuse that's kind of leveled. Now, you know, you say all that, and that is true, and it's horrible. When you're the public representative, and I can only speak for myself in this regard, but you can kind of not necessarily brush it off, but you can take it on the chin and go, that's grand. Mm-hmm. The annoying thing is that the people around you are affected by it too. Yeah, so like my husband or my family or my friends or whatever. And then they're worried for you, and they're worried for, you know, anything that's been said or anything that might happen or might be said in the future.
And Park, would you find yourself in the situation where you might see something and you would raise it whichever way you wish to raise it to Declan? He bats it away and goes, look, it's just blah, 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 blah. And you're like, no, excuse me.
We tend to try
we're not having that.
We tend to try and not talk about it. One of Declan's best mates, Eamon, does a lot of his social media monitoring, I guess, and probably protects us from a lot. And I know that Eamon doesn't tell us half of what he deletes and what we don't see and what he hides and so on. I think it is tough, you know, and I think particularly the threats on Declan's life, which happened a couple of times, and the threats on our home and the threats to burn us out of our home, and, you know, having the Gardaí call and having to get cameras and panic alarms and, you know, thinking about...
That's proper stuff, like. It's not just like, you know, block...
No,
you know, you know what I mean? Yeah. That's real.
You know, I remember the first time it happened, looking around our bedroom, being like, well, if someone comes to attack me in this room tonight, what's around that I can defend us with? And that's a huge invasion of your, you know, anyone can take criticism. We can all do that. That is different to saying that you're going to burn down someone's home. I think is just where it starts to become dangerous. And unfortunately, you know, trying to action that with the Gardaí and stuff is difficult. Now there are stuff ongoing, but it is difficult then because the laws, unfortunately, aren't terribly great at protecting people in the public.
What's it going to take for that to happen? Because sometimes I wonder, have we hit the peak? You know, and will we see sort of this sort of online stuff, this rhetoric retreating? Maybe if there's a ban on social media for under 16s, inevitably that means grown-ups are also going to have to ID themselves to prove that they're not under that age. Or is it going to take, God forbid, another incident where someone is targeted, someone follows through in it, Porrig, and then all of a sudden we have this huge... That being said, there's been some very high profile deaths in UK politics. Yeah. It hasn't really fundamentally changed.
There's been three MPs killed in the last number of years. Yeah.
And it hasn't necessarily...
No, I think it has to be... I think there has to be a genuine targeted campaign from the Gardaí that says that, you know, it's fine to criticise someone and disagree with their politics or whatever, but it's not okay. And once you do that, should be considered in the same way if someone had attacked you with something or someone threatens to attack you with something. It's the same thing online than it is in person, because you actually don't know what that person is capable of. And I've certainly seen in my job where people, you're just not 100% sure what anybody is capable of at any point, for lots and a variety of reasons. I do think that's something that for politicians and for people in the public eye, not even just politicians, people in the public eye in general across the state, there will need to be a change in legislation that makes that there's a much bigger consequence for those people doing those things.
Yeah, I think it's the legislative piece that's important there, because Gardaí can only enforce what's in law. They can't if it's not there. And I think that that's something that, you know, needs to change from Leinster House, basically. They need to legislate for that. And it's not about clamping down on people's freedom of speech. It's about actually identifying where there's threatening language.
But you see, once you got to that first part of that sentence, that's where politicians don't want to go down there.
Because
I think you would need to have a, you know, 90% approval rate to have the balls to do something like that. What is also really strange is the size of this world, that you can actually see who's pulling the strings in the anti-censorship movement and for what reasons. Mm-hmm. So it's not really an Irish decision, and it's not really a European decision. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a Mark Zuckerberg, Donald Trump, Elon Musk. And you can actually see where it's all happening. Mm-hmm. Whereby,
but when they're constantly sitting at the top table with the world's leaders, you can kind of absolutely see where some of the power actually lies. But like, I suppose the other thing is, you know, you are subject to some online abuse, certainly never mind being criticized. I really welcome when someone contacts me and says, I'm not happy with how you voted on this. Mm-hmm. I'm not happy with what you said in Highland Radio or whatever, and to engage and have a discussion on it. And usually, you know, 9 times out of 10, those interactions like are so valuable and are so worthwhile, because you understand each other's position, you move on, you may agree or disagree or whatever it is at the end of it, and then move on from it. But the vast majority of social media interaction that I have is actually very positive. You know, there is an awful lot of negative, but it is in a minority at the same time, which is good.
I don't use Twitter anymore. I don't use Twitter, but I find it funny, but it's not funny really. I don't want to have to do beeping. So what was it about? It was about, someone online took a clip of a court case we were doing about a foreign national who had been, but anyway, the fella commented, it's my fault. The cause of all this, with his lefty rhetoric the last 5 years, little baldy C word has speaking up. has been sticking up for these animals every chance he gets. F you at Greg Hughes too, right? Yeah. Now, I don't mind that, but it's not... What can you do with that? You can't even tease it out.
No, you can't.
And that's mild. Like, we're talking... because there's a line, right, Porrig? We know the line, don't we?
Yeah.
It's not... You know, you're a tool. It's not your. It's actually really when it goes beyond. It goes into an area. That's why it shouldn't be hard for us to police it, because we know what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and you need a thick skin to be in politics in the public eye. That's not what we're talking about.
Yeah, my favorite was when someone gave Declan a good go on social media for wearing pink shorts to an event, and then lots of homophobic abuse with those pink shorts. But that was actually quite funny. I enjoyed that one. It's when it's actually very nice. I think it's more when it starts to become, you know, threatening about, oh, well, we'll see what he does when his lights are turned out tonight. Or, do you know, where they'll comment and being like, it's time we rounded those fellas up, or those kind of things. Mm-hmm. That's when it becomes highly threatening. And, you know, you do lose sleep over it.
Yeah, of course you do. Broadly speaking, where do you think we are at as a society, sort of in... You know, you guys being a gay married couple, are we seeing, like, for me, most people I know, well, actually everyone, I don't know anyone or associate with anyone that have a problem with it, right? So I have to go seek them out. That's the absolute God's honest truth. But obviously there are people out there, and I'm curious from your perspective, either of your perspective, are we going backwards in that space, or... Are we? Are you able to enjoy, and will always be able to enjoy those hard fought for the ability to live the life that you live? And there's people that have given up everything, given up their lives to get to where we are today in that space. Are we going backwards? No,
I don't. I don't think we are. I genuinely don't.
I think there are people who are trying to make us think we're going backwards to try and make us go backwards.
See, and I'm conscious that I could be influenced by that, so I'm quite interested to have the conversation.
It's a minority that's always been there. Mm. You know, a minority. Well, you know, it used to be a majority, but now it's a minority of people. I think that some of them have become emboldened by hiding behind you know, a social media account to vocalize their prejudices or whatever else. And that gets amplified because that's what social media does, right? I think that that minority of people are much more vocal. They're much more likely to post. They're much more likely to call in. They're much more likely to do whatever.
But they are in a motivated. Small echo chamber, aren't they?
They are,
I think. I want to tease that a little bit further than that because, I mean, you know, obviously it's the community is broadened, the banner is broadened, LGBTQI plus. And, you know, in terms of for the trans community, particularly non-binaries, etc., you know, we've seen the EHRC guidelines coming into effect, I believe, on the 5th of August. And you can see that conversation beginning to happen here as well, right? So how does that fit into it all?
Look, I think that for me...
Is this controversial to talk about for you?
No.
Okay.
No, yeah, no, right. It's certainly not. For me, like, I am 100%, we both are, stand squarely behind the trans community and stand with them. And I believe that the trans community make up such a tiny proportion of the population. So small. And they are being very successfully scapegoated by certain sections.
But can I say, without getting into a debate, you see, that just to switch a little bit, it's what they want affects 50% of the population potentially, if we're talking about the EHRC guidelines, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, sure. But this is, again, like, for me, that's like, for me, that particular argument around it affects 50% of the population, we're talking about shared spaces, right? Gendered spaces, of which, you know, an awful lot of facilities nowadays are multi-gender. They're not just for male or female. And I think that the scaremongering that goes along with that is actually extraordinary because the evidence isn't there to back it up.
Yeah, exactly.
The evidence is not there to say what trans people are a threat.
Yeah.
Trans people are not a threat. What is more concerning is who are the biggest proponents of domestic violence? But just not trans people.
Yeah, but just in relation to that.
It's male partners or male people known.
Of course
known.
It is. Of
Do you know what I mean?
Is.
But and just this in is that, why it's is, deflective. And it shouldn't be.
But even within the trans community, because I tend not to try and talk about something unless I look into a little bit. There seems to be sort of a little bit of friction within that community and within the broader sort of the wider community then, in that, you know, whether someone makes an effort to pass as and all that kind of stuff. Do you know what I mean? So I don't think it's even that simple a conversation sort of within the trans community. It is. What do you think, Porrig? Because, as I say, there are also people, gay people that I would know, and they would say quietly that, you know, I hope we don't lose the ground that we've got here because...
With the help of trans people.
Yeah. No, of course. No, this is not a point. It's a question.
Yeah.
And you can have that conversation with them with the help of trans people, of course, but that we could lose with the progress we've made now because, you know, trans people are quite rightly in the same group as the LGBTIQ.
Well, that's called pulling up the ladder, Greg.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what that is. That's like somebody moving from another country. And it's, you know, and you see it all the time, particularly, I think, in the UK, but you see it all the time where somebody moves or they're second generation and then they pull up the ladder and forget about the people coming after them.
Yes.
I'll remind everybody that the first Pride in Stonewall was started by a trans woman. And so they have been there from the very start. And this sort of narrative that people sometimes have that, you know, there's extra letters being added on all the time. Actually, the first letter was T, really. They're the first ones who started Pride. And then the question I would ask is if they come for the T and they're successful, do they keep going on the letters to get rid of all the rest of them as well? That's one of the reasons we do Pride in Letterkenny, actually, is to show people in Letterkenny that this is a very safe space to be, and it broadly is. I do sometimes despair when I see, particularly online, but in general, people talking about this shared space argument. And I get it, right? Because women have been threatened in spaces all of their lives. And they are exposed to violence all of their lives. And they're always watching where the next threat is coming, in the same way that straight men don't do. Gay men do, they're looking around their shoulder at night when they're walking home. And as Panty says, what gave the gay away? You know, what made us look so targeting? And I get that. But I would say to those people, when was the last time you ever heard of a trans person attacking somebody in a bathroom ever? Ever. But when was the last time they heard of a straight man attacking somebody in a bathroom? Mm. Every day, every single day. I think it's when you look at, and I'm not a woman and I don't want to speak for women, right? But I am an ally of trans people. And I think it's important to push back and say that trans person going into a cubicle in a female toilet caused a threat to nobody and, you know, has never been an issue for anybody. And if somebody wants to direct their energy and their all of their online might and gusto against somebody who's threatening towards women, I think I would start in the place where the evidence shows it is.
Mm. Yeah, I understand. And it's a complex topic and we can do it in a different format. I just think that, you know, the extreme of the argument is that someone goes in and hurts someone. And you see that also too on the other side, that a trans woman can't go into a male's toilet because they'll get beaten up as well. And I'm not sure that's not really what we're talking about. I think it's about maybe how people feel about themselves, their identity, their spaces and privacy and stuff. But again, you know, I just wonder where that whole conversation is going to end. But as you say, they come for the tea, what's next? Is that a genuine fear, Declan?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that the people who are, I suppose, pushing this transphobic, anti-trans narrative don't give a damn about gay rights. They don't give a damn about lesbian rights. Do you know what I mean? They don't. They're not the people who...
Many of them don't give a damn about women's rights.
Yeah, and many of them don't give a damn about women's rights.
Probably don't even like themselves.
Yeah. They're not... Like, you know, you can't take these people seriously when their only concern centres around trans people and it doesn't centre around actual proponents of domestic violence or gendered violence. And they're not people who stood shoulder to shoulder with gay people when they're looking for liberation. So it's a it's not genuine. The concern's not genuine. It's just the latest kind of outworkings of...
But you see a lot of that. And I find this frustrating. And this is not having to go at anyone left or right or middle, because it's all a horseshoe to me anyway. It always ends up back at the same place. But, you know, like... And I'm not getting into... We don't really have time for the immigration thing. Say that sounds so dismissive, but I don't mean it like that. But, you know, like, you can see on Donegal Daily, like, you know, 10 posts of this guy abused his grandchildren. This was a serial rapist. This, that, and done. You know, 2 likes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, 1 thumb down, Sinead. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Away you go. And, you know, someone with brown skin is accused of doing something. It's horrendous. But it doesn't even have to be the far end of the scale as such. And it's just, you know, 1,000 shares. Now, my view on that and the reason I mention it is we need to get into a place whereby, you know, violence against women is, you get outraged either way.
Yeah.
Abuse of children, you get outraged regardless of, You know what I mean? And I think it really is sad that we kind of, word can come out that there's, you know, another 22 babies found in Galway and it's page 9 in a corner of a paper. It doesn't, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Look, if we care, let's care. We can't be a la carte careists.
Mm. Yeah. We also have to be aware, I guess, of bots and social media and what's real and what's not real. And algorithms are designed to push what sell social media and
rage bait
as it's called, but also just like when you, if you ever explore some of those, I mean, I try not to because it's not good for someone's mental health, but when you explore some of those accounts that are commenting on those, you quickly realize they're not real.
Well, and also too, what was very useful actually, and I can't say much about X, is when the country of origin, the amount of people outside of Ireland with such a stern interest. Yeah. I don't like the algorithms anyway, because I watch a lot of cooking videos on Instagram, Snap, and there was this woman. She was a woman, of course, because that's the story. And she was making chili con carne, and I was actually genuinely fascinated by the chili con carne she was making. And I did at some point notice that she was quite well proportioned, and she didn't have very much clothes on. But TikTok just thought I was interested in her boobs for like 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. Not the chili con carne. And it took me so long
to rebalance your algorithm.
You'd be like, what? Yeah. That's not chili con carne. To purge.
It's veered into something else.
But my point being is, and it's a frivolous point, but you stay on a video for any time at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, so maybe that could be about a bit of toxic masculinity or self-harm or whatever it might
absolutely.
Be.
Absolutely, that's the danger. Yeah.
And they just bombard you with it.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes it's less, sometimes more subtle than my example, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know.
And if you're vulnerable and maybe you're lonely and maybe you don't have a tribe in life and maybe you're not sure what you're all about yet and all those things, there are highly influential videos and that's where it becomes problematic.
Right, you've met online. Very we modern did. Of you. Yes.
Swiped right, yeah.
Was it? Yeah. Was it, were you both living in Donegal at that time?
No, we were, I was living in Belfast studying medicine and Declan was in Dublin and I went down for the weekend. We actually swiped right in 2013 and took about 6 months to get our calendars synchronized. It's a problem we still struggle
so
with,
romantic.
Disgusted with. Yeah, very romantic.
It definitely is more romantic.
Do you remember that day we got our calendars synchronized?
It was a little more ad hoc than that. And then Declan happened to be moving to Belfast less than six months later to do your master's in politics in Queen's. So it was kind of serendipitous.
Yeah.
And then we moved in relatively quickly, less than a year. Mm-hmm. And that was 12 years ago.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah,
yeah.
We got married in 2019. Rather.
What was the wedding like?
It was class.
How would you describe the style of it or the theme of
Donegal
it?
Donegal themed. Everything was Donegal themed.
Yeah, very much Donegal themed.
Everywhere we could shoehorn in a Donegal reference, we did.
Did you do the mixing of sand from different beaches or anything like that? No,
we did a hand fasting ceremony. So okay. We did the other thing with the ribbons.
Lovely.
We had our ceremony in Aireachtliingeadore. So it was the first time they'd ever done a wedding.
Yeah.
Never mind a gay wedding.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was amazing. They were amazing. It was a beautiful venue to do it in.
Yeah.
And then afterwards we had the reception in the waterfront in Dunloe and they were fantastic beautiful. Too. So we had a great, great weekend. It was class. It was brilliant. Yeah.
We showcased Donegal, I think, to a lot of people that weekend, which is great because lots of friends not from here and they think that Donegal is like going to Alaska.
Yeah.
And it was great because we brought them around and showed them lots of West Donegal and up into where we live now. And it was great.
It was an opportunity to plug the Wild Atlantic Way.
Yeah, we should have been sponsored by Folger Ireland. But
is it both very busy? What about children?
Not on our radar. Yeah.
No. Really?
No. Yeah.
We discussed it before we got married, which I think any couple should do, really. Not just of the same sex, but... It's just not for us. We have really busy lives and I think trying to, not that parents don't in general, I don't mean that, but
I know what your people understand exactly what you mean by that, yeah.
And it's just, you know, I think I admire and I see parents all the time coming in with 3 or 4 kids and then maybe throw a sick kid in there or a child with disabilities of varying sorts. And I just think it's so incredibly tough to be a parent.
Really?
And I think it's really difficult to be a parent and it's only getting more difficult.
But it's incredibly rewarding.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
It is. Like, you know, it really is. But it's a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Do you know?
We'll stick with our Cocker Spaniel Fanula. Yeah, exactly. Just,
but I would argue that your Cocker Spaniel Fanula is tougher than Hudson. The rare,
yeah.
Honestly,
yeah.
That is age now. You just throw him a phone.
Yeah. Here's a screen.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? No, I'm messing. But but it's not. It's not a no-no. We'll see. It's not something that's just not on your radar.
No.
And what about getting away together? What do you like to do for fun?
Yeah, we do like to get away. We like to travel a good bit.
Favorite place?
I don't know. We like to go somewhere new all the time. Yeah, try and see as much as possible.
Yeah.
So I don't think we really have favorite.
That's
place.
What the thing. I watch a lot of A Place in the Sun, and part of it, you know, you think right, I'd like that. But
yeah. But actually,
how long does it take before it feels like which is home and which kind of feels like I'd like a break from?
Exactly. Yeah. So I think we like to go somewhere new. Now, favorite place to visit in Ireland is probably Westport. We love there a good bit as well. We love the crack there. So we do like to get away, like to go out for a few pints, out for a bite to eat, just kind of.
We're keen gardeners as well. And We recently acquired an old Victorian garden that needs a lot of work. So we're trying to put some manners on that and create something beautiful.
That sounds fantastic. Is there stuff within it that shows its age that you can sort of enhance and bring back? And
Or is it
strip it back and start from the beginning?
No, Joe? there's a good bit that's still intact. So it's a lovely spot. Yeah.
We're lucky.
I like that.
Very lucky. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel better getting my robot lawnmower now. Yeah. I just don't have the time. And on your average day, how do you chill? Is it the usual, just a bit of TV?
A bit of TV in the evening.
You actually mentioned the lawnmower, Greg. I wouldn't like one of them, and I'll tell you why. I enjoy the hour a week it is during the summer to just go over and back in straight lines and not have to think about anything else but keeping the line straight.
You are such a noob. You walk behind the robot mower. You don't go inside. You walk behind
Follow it round.
Yes. Yeah. And go, look, look. No one else is interested in what it's doing. I discuss something? This is probably going to be controversial. The various incarnations of your moustache.
Pretty consistent, I thought, what
you have at the moment is quite discreet. Sometimes it has got quite pronounced.
When you trim this,
yes,
then it's more pronounced.
Do you like the moustache? What's the story? Parag, I'm going to be coming to you in a moment.
Well, it's it's probably because Podge likes it, to be honest. Yeah, I don't know. It was
I think I got you on a Zoom call once. It might have been maybe it was a Movember, but you kept that and got rid of everything else or something along those lines.
Yeah,
I remember thinking, that's a statement.
Yeah. And it's still here.
Yeah. I enjoy it. My father is one. I don't know what that says. I enjoy it. Now, there are times where Declan accidentally goes over with a razor, so then it takes months to regrow back again.
Months.
Weeks.
Yeah.
But no, I definitely enjoy it. I think it's
Well, sorry, can I finish on your moustache? That sounds terrible. But my point is there anything else we need to talk about? We'll leave it there. Listen, both of you, thank you so very much for calling in. It's actually great to get an insight, Declan, to you behind sort of the politics and stuff. And also, Parag, obviously a lot of people became more familiar with you with the fantastic advocacy work that you did on the surgical hub and continue to do in other spaces. It's going to be hopefully a wonderful achievement. So thanks both of you so very much for calling in.
Thanks for having us, Greg.